Undoubtedly, dermatologists have a strong tradition for being syphilologists. Some believe that without syphilis, there wouldn't have been the separation of the specialty of dermatology, or external medicine, from internal medicine. The miraculous discovery of penicillin changed the landscape of how we dealt with this disease. But syphilis is not a forgotten disease, and it continues to bring misery to those infected with the spirochete. In this dialogue, Dr. Kenneth A. Katz and Dr. Jason Lott discuss the subject of syphilis in the 21st century, a topic of concern to all dermatologists and other leaders in the public health sector.
Hi, my name is Jason Lott. I'm a dermatologist and postdoctoral fellow in the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at Yale University. And today I'm very happy to have Dr. Kenneth A. Katz join us for this Dialogues in Dermatology. Dr. Katz is a dermatologist with the Permanente Medical Group. He's a volunteer consultant dermatologist at San Francisco General Hospital, and he has extensive expertise in public health. He used to work at the CDC, as well as the local public health departments in San Diego and San Francisco. Dr. Katz, welcome.
Thanks very much, Jason.
So I'm very excited about today's topic. I know Dr. Katz as well. We're talking about sex, sores, science, surveillance, and syphilis in the 21st century. Very interesting topic. And so Dr. Katz, maybe you should just give us some idea of why syphilis is important for dermatologists and why this area is of such great interest to you.
Sure. Well, there are a number of things I'd like to highlight. I think, first of all, it's good to provide a basic review of what syphilis is, especially for dermatologists who might not see it a lot. And that, I think, starts with a knowledge of what causes it. And it's a bacterial disease caused by a bacterium called Treponema pallidum, variant pallidum. There are other treponemes that cause other treponemal diseases like yaws and pinta that are closely related. This bacterium is a spirochete. You know, it's got that corkscrew shape that's typical of spirochetes. And what happens first is exposure to the bacteria. And that typically, in the United States, happens through sexual contact. It can also happen from non-sexual contact, congenital exposure, occupational exposure, or bloodborne exposure. But in the vast majority of cases in the United States these days, it's really sexual exposure. And the exposure is skin to skin, or skin to mucous membrane, or mucous membrane to skin exposure. It's not present in semen or other body fluids. For that reason, condoms are only somewhat, they're not fully protective. And it's very infectious. There's a 30 to 50% risk of infection following exposure to a contagious lesion of syphilis, and that includes chancres, mucus patches, or condyloma lata.
So can you tell us a little bit about what the clinical presentation is for syphilis that we should highlight?
Sure. Well, after exposure, the first manifestation of syphilis is the chancre. And that appears 10 to 90 days after exposure, an average of about 3 weeks after exposure. It starts as a small red papule that then ulcerates and often develops an elevated border. It's indurated, sort of like the tip of your nose or your ear. It's rather hard. It's typically painless, and it's very infectious. It's really teeming with spirochetes. Often patients will develop non-tender lymphadenopathy 1 to 2 weeks after the chancre itself develops. And the chancre lasts for 2 to 6 weeks, and then it spontaneously heals without scarring, which is really brilliant of the bacterium because people think that they're done and it's gone. That's not the case.
So that's very interesting. And certainly, as with anything in dermatology, there's always a differential diagnosis. And so for the chancre of primary syphilis, could you review what you consider the meaningful clinical differential diagnosis for this disease?
I would divide it into two categories. There are infectious causes of genital ulcers and non-infectious causes of genital ulcers. And one thing to remember is that we're classically taught that the chancre is a solitary sore. That's not always the case. It can present as multiple genital ulcers as well. So we think about other diseases that can cause multiple genital ulcers, such as herpes simplex virus, or perhaps zoster in the right distribution. Other infectious causes include bacterial, like staph aureus. And then there are a number of rare causes, things that were taught as medical students and residents, but are very uncommon in practice: chancroid, granuloma inguinale, lymphogranuloma venereum. And finally, candidiasis can present as ulcers in the genital area. And then there are a number of non-infectious causes. Behçet's disease, fixed drug eruption can ulcerate, traumatic injuries, factitious disorders, and cancer that one should think about as well.
I was wondering if we could move on now to talk about secondary syphilis, its clinical presentations, and could you tell us about that?
Sure. Secondary syphilis is the next stage of syphilis, as you mentioned, and it occurs either during primary syphilis, there can be overlap of those two phases, or after primary syphilis. It can occur up to 6 months after the initial exposure to the bacterium. It lasts about 3 to 8 weeks, and it's protean in its manifestations, and it mimics many other diseases. It can present with lesions on the trunk, the palms and soles, the scrotum, elsewhere on the genitals. It can present with so-called moth-eaten alopecia, mucus patches in the oral cavity or in the corners of the mouth called split papules, condyloma lata in the genital area. And often patients with secondary syphilis have systemic symptoms like fever, malaise, and lymphadenopathy.
I know that we always hear that syphilis is one of the great mimickers. What is the differential for secondary syphilis?
Right. Well, it really depends on the manifestation of secondary syphilis. I'll just cover a couple of the common manifestations of secondary syphilis, the trunk rash and the palmoplantar rash. For the trunk rash, I think the one that dermatologists classically think of and we should think of is pityriasis rosea. But I think the more important one is other viral exanthemes, including acute HIV infection, because often patients who are at risk of syphilis are also at risk of HIV, and that's really one that we don't want to miss. So pityriasis rosea, viral exanthemes, including HIV, drug eruptions, other inflammatory dermatoses. For the palmoplantar rash, we can think about entities like hand, foot, and mouth disease, which is enjoying a resurgence, including among adults, erythema multiforme, Rocky Mountain spotted fever as well.
So we've covered primary syphilis, and we've covered secondary syphilis, and I was wondering if you could tell us now, moving forward, logically, about latent syphilis.
Right. Well, latent syphilis is generally what happens after secondary syphilis. And latent syphilis, by definition, means that there are no signs or symptoms of disease other than serologic evidence of infection. And in this period, so patients aren't experiencing any problems, but 25% of them will relapse to secondary syphilis during the period of latent syphilis, which can last between 2 to 20 years. And then some patients will develop tertiary disease if left untreated. And we know this, unfortunately, from so-called experiments that unfortunately occurred in Tuskegee. We know that tertiary syphilis can affect the cardiovascular system, it can affect the bones, and it can affect the nervous system.
Dr. Katz, I was wondering if you could tell us now about the treatment of syphilis.
Yeah, treatment of syphilis really depends on the stage. But for primary, secondary, and early latent syphilis, the stages of syphilis that collectively are called early syphilis in adults, it's really simple. It's penicillin. It's one of the few organisms that has not developed resistance to penicillin. And the appropriate treatment in these cases is benzathine penicillin G, 2.4 million units in a single dose intramuscularly. Now, for patients who have an allergy to penicillin, there is an option if they are not pregnant, and that's doxycycline, 100 milligrams orally twice per day for 14 days. If the patient is pregnant, however, the only acceptable treatment is penicillin, and those patients must be desensitized, treated with benzathine penicillin G, 2.4 million units intramuscularly in a single dose. For a treatment of other stages of syphilis, for neurosyphilis and for children, I would refer listeners to the CDC STD treatment guidelines from 2010, the most recent edition.
Are there complications of treatment that clinicians should be aware about?
Certainly. There's one in particular, the Jarisch-Herxheimer reaction. That is an acute febrile reaction to dying treponemes that presents with flu-like symptoms. It usually occurs within 24 hours after treatment and occurs most frequently with syphilis that has a high burden of disease. So this is people who have a bad rash, who have a lot of treponemes in their system that are dying, and therefore the body is responding to lots of bacterial death. It's really important to tell people about this because often patients, if they're unaware of it, will think they're experiencing a penicillin allergy, which is not the case, but it gets them into the emergency room inappropriately, and it makes them think to tell doctors down the line that they are allergic to penicillin and therefore cuts them off from a potentially very valuable class of antibiotics. They can be managed with acetaminophen.
How do we assess whether or not our treatment is working?
There are two main ways. The clinical response is, are the sores going away? Is the rash going away? Is the patient feeling better? That might take a few weeks, but you should see some progress. The second is the serologic response. Serology is really the critical way to monitor response from a laboratory perspective. And what we're looking for is a fourfold decline in non-treponemal test titers. Non-treponemal tests include the RPR and the VDRL. And what we want to see is a fourfold decline. For example, if somebody started with a titer of 1 to 64, we would like to see them in an appropriate time frame, usually 6 to 12 months, be at 1 to 16 or lower. And if they're not there, we have to think about treatment failure, or perhaps the person has experienced another case of syphilis. I just want to add that it's really important to check a day of treatment titer, by which I mean checking the titer on the same day that the patient receives their penicillin or alternatively their doxycycline. And that's important in assessing response down the line, because if we know the patient's titer a week ago, it doesn't necessarily tell us where the patient is today. That titer can change, and we really need to know where they are today in order to be able to interpret the serology 6 or 12 months down the line.
And after these patients have been treated or during their treatment, what do you recommend in terms of follow-up?
I recommend serologic follow-up basically every 3 months after they present. And that's really for two reasons. First, we want to see that the serology is declining appropriately, particularly in the 6 to 12 months timeframe that we're really looking for a response. And the second reason is that it turns out that a big risk factor for syphilis is having had it in the past. So we want to make sure that we're checking these patients frequently so that if they get syphilis, we're catching it early.
So I was wondering if you wanted to tell us a little bit about congenital syphilis.
Sure. Congenital syphilis presents in ways that mimic the presentation of secondary syphilis in adults in some ways. The most common findings are rash, for example, on the trunk and the palms and the soles, similar to secondary syphilis in adults. Other symptoms include fever, failure to thrive, and hepatosplenomegaly. Another common finding is snuffles, which refers to the discharge from the nose that is actually very highly infectious. And finally, many of the lesions can be bullous in a way that they are not typically in adults.
Right, so-called pemphigus syphilitis.
Correct.
That's excellent. Thank you for that review. I think an area which may be confusing to some people, certainly sometimes to me, it's hard for me to keep straight, is the topic of neurosyphilis. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, neurosyphilis is something that I think is tricky. And the reason it's tricky is that many of us were taught to think about neurosyphilis as exclusively occurring as a part of tertiary syphilis, things like tabes dorsalis or general paresis of the insane. But there's a whole other category of neurosyphilis that occurs during early syphilis, and it's termed early neurosyphilis, that can really be devastating to patients and occurs very early in the course of infection.
So what characterizes early neurosyphilis?
Yeah, as opposed to the dementia that we see in general paresis of the insane or the abnormal gait findings and nervous system abnormalities that we see in tabes dorsalis, the syndromes associated with early neurosyphilis are quite different. And these have been described in the past decade or so, and most involve cranial nerve dysfunction, especially ocular nerve dysfunction, meningitis, meningovascular syndromes, including strokes, and other syndromes such as headache, altered mental status, or both.
So how do you assess for neurosyphilis?
Yeah, I think it's really critical to assess every patient with syphilis for signs and symptoms of neurosyphilis, early neurosyphilis. And the way I recommend doing that is by a focused neurological exam, first of all, that focuses on cranial nerve function, sensory and motor function, coordination, gait and Romberg testing, and also testing the range of motion in the neck. And second, it's important to do a good neurologic review of systems, the eyes, the ears, the neck, the balance, memory, and sensation, and range of motion of the neck. If dermatologists don't feel comfortable doing that neurologic exam, then they should refer to a colleague who is comfortable doing that. The reason it's so important to do that is that patients with neurosyphilis require different treatment than patients without neurosyphilis.
Which patients with syphilis require a lumbar puncture?
There are three groups of patients that should undergo a lumbar puncture for collection of cerebrospinal fluid, according to CDC guidelines, the most recent CDC guidelines, because those have changed in the last decade or so. The first group is patients who have any neurologic, otologic, or ophthalmic signs or symptoms that are suggestive of neurosyphilis. The second group is patients with suspected treatment failure, either clinically or serologically. And the third is patients with evidence of active tertiary syphilis. In practice, it's patients who have signs or symptoms of early neurosyphilis that we're going to encounter who are going to require lumbar puncture. Note that there are no specific indications related to HIV infection status or titer. There used to be, but those are no longer triggers for a lumbar puncture according to CDC guidelines.
Could you tell us what's happening with the epidemiology of syphilis in the United States?
Sure. Well, taking the long view, if you look at data since 1941, which is when the U.S. started systematically collecting epidemiologic data on syphilis, it's been a success because the total number of cases back in 1941 approached 600,000 per year. And in looking at today's rates, they're orders of magnitude lower. But if you look at the last 12 or so years, you see a rise in cases. And the number of primary and secondary syphilis cases in the United States increased from nearly 6,000 in the year 2000 to nearly 16,000 in 2012, the last year for which we have data available. That's a nearly threefold rise. So we're moving in the wrong direction.
So given these epidemiological trends for syphilis, which groups of patients are at greatest risk?
At highest risk now, the group that's really been disproportionately affected in the last 12 years in terms of increasing rates of syphilis is men who have sex with men. Those trend lines are really going up, whereas men who have sex with women and women, the trend lines are essentially flat. That underscores the importance of taking a good sexual history of patients who might be suspected of having syphilis, particularly with regard to the gender of their sex partner or partners. I'll also add that within the group of men who have sex with men, it's really people living with HIV who have been disproportionately affected by syphilis. Having said that, there are still areas of the country where heterosexual transmission is still very much a problem, and that is particularly in the Southeast and the Midwest.
And how are we doing in terms of congenital syphilis?
Well, the number of cases in 2012 was 322, which is orders of magnitude lower than it was decades ago, but it's still 322 too many.
That is very surprising. So what's new in the laboratory diagnosis of syphilis that we should be aware of?
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes, or really one big change in terms of the laboratory approach to diagnosing syphilis. I think a lot of us learned and are familiar with the traditional algorithm in the laboratory for testing for syphilis, and that starts with a non-treponemal test, such as an RPR or a VDRL. If that test is non-reactive, essentially, we can stop. There are a number of cases in which we shouldn't stop, but for the most part, we can stop right there. If the non-treponemal test is reactive, then we go on to doing a treponemal test, something like a TPPA, a TPHA, or an FTA-ABS test. If that treponemal test is reactive, then we have a case of syphilis. It might be an old case of syphilis, that, by which I mean previously treated, or it might be a new case of syphilis. If the treponemal test is non-reactive, then for the most part, we can say that the non-treponemal test represents a biologic false positive due to perhaps infection, inflammation, drug use, perhaps pregnancy, or other causes of biological false positives. What's new is called the reverse sequence screening algorithm for syphilis, and that flips the order of the non-treponemal and treponemal tests. So instead of doing the non-treponemal test first, you do a treponemal test first.
That's very interesting. So why would one perform a treponemal-based test first?
The reason is the same reason that we used to perform the non-treponemal test first, and that is that the treponemal test, because of advances in laboratory techniques that have created enzyme immunoassays and chemiluminescent assays, have made it so that it's cheaper and easier in the laboratory to do the treponemal test first and the non-treponemal test then afterwards.
So what does that mean for us as dermatologists?
Well, what it means is that instead of seeing the result of an RPR or a VDRL test when we order syphilis serology, we might be seeing instead the result of an EIA or a CLIA test. And we have to know what that means and how to interpret it. And you interpret that like you would a treponemal test, so it's reactive or non-reactive. Things can get a little tricky when you have a reactive treponemal test like the EIA and the CLIA, and then a non-reactive, non-treponemal test, such as the RPR or the VDRL. And the reason it's tricky is that we didn't see that combination of test results typically under the old algorithm, because under the old algorithm, we would simply do the non-treponemal test, and if that were negative, then we would stop. So we wouldn't see a non-treponemal test being non-reactive and treponemal test being reactive. If you encounter that category of test results, probably worth consulting with the health department or an infectious disease specialist.
Dr. Katz, are there issues with antibiotic resistance that our listeners should know about concerning syphilis?
Yes. Well, the good news is that no cases of syphilis have been resistant to penicillin, which is still the mainstay of treatment, and we have another alternative treatment for non-pregnant patients, which is doxycycline. However, in the last 10 years or so, antibiotic resistance in Treponema pallidum has emerged to macrolides, and that occurred first in San Francisco, where azithromycin was being used to treat patients. It was effective. It was a lot easier to take than a shot of penicillin, and it was very convenient for patients and providers alike. But cases of treatment failure began to develop in 2002 and 2003. Subsequent genomic analysis that was published ultimately in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2004 showed that a single point mutation from A to G in position 2058 of the Treponema pallidum genome was responsible for conferring that resistance to macrolides. So they're no longer a good treatment option in the United States for the most part. In the developing world, perhaps there's more ability for us to use them, but with caution.
So avoid macrolide use for syphilis if possible.
Yes.
Dr. Katz, based upon your expertise in syphilis, are there any pearls that you could offer us?
Sure. There are a couple that I think are important to keep in mind. The first is to make sure that we're ordering the right type of penicillin. Penicillin comes in many different varieties. And the treatment for early syphilis, as I mentioned, is benzathine penicillin G, which is sold under the trade name Bicillin LA. The LA stands for long acting. The issue is that there's another formulation of penicillin that's sold as Bicillin CR. And it's easy to confuse those two. In fact, there have been many cases in which providers have ordered the wrong formulation of penicillin. It's important to order the right formulation of benzathine because it has a very long half-life in the body that's important for treating a bacterium such as Treponema pallidum, which is very slowly dividing. So make sure we're ordering, if we're ordering by trade name, Bicillin LA, which is exclusively benzathine penicillin G without any other formulations of penicillin. The second pearl is to report the case promptly to the health department. That's important for two reasons. The first is it's required by law, not only for laboratories, but also for providers to report to the health department throughout the United States. And it's important because it provides additional information beyond what public health departments can get from the laboratory. Specifically, it allows the public health department to know what stage the patient is in. And it's important that the public health department know that in order to prioritize resources for reaching out to these patients to ask them who their sexual contacts have been so that the chain of transmission can be stopped as quickly as possible.
Dr. Katz, this has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
Once known as the Great Pox in the 15th century, syphilis, which gained its name from the afflicted child protagonist in Frank Astoro's 1530 epic poem, Syphilitis Sive Morbi Gallici, remains a disease of ongoing importance to dermatologists worldwide. Perhaps best known for its protean clinical manifestations, the status of the proverbial great imitator was once surmised by William Osler as such. He who knows syphilis knows medicine. In this dialogue, Dr. Kenneth Katz shared his wisdom on syphilis, sex, sores, science, and surveillance in the 21st century. Primarily a sexually transmitted disease, although infection may also occur through congenital, occupational, and bloodborne exposures, syphilis is caused by the spirochete Treponema pallidum via contact with skin and/or mucous membranes. As Dr. Katz noted, the bacterium is not typically present in semen or other bodily fluids, and condoms may confer only limited protection for this highly transmissible disease, which infects up to 50% of individuals following exposure to contagious lesions. The latter includes self-healing painless chancres, a manifestation of primary syphilis appearing approximately 3 weeks after exposure and lasting 2 to 6 weeks. oral mucus patches, shallow erosions and erosions covered by a gray exudate appearing in secondary syphilis, and condyloma lata, red-brown, flat, moist papules found in the genital region during secondary syphilis. Latent syphilis, an asymptomatic stage, may follow secondary syphilis and last for decades, during which time reversion to secondary syphilis may occur. If untreated, tertiary syphilis may result, afflicting the nervous, cardiovascular, and musculoskeletal systems. Whereas these and other signs of syphilis remain familiar to all dermatologists, our approach to laboratory diagnosis of this disorder has undergone an important recent change. Traditionally, physicians would first order a non-treponemal assay, such as a rapid plasma reagent, or RPR, or venereal disease research laboratory VDRL test, which, if reactive, would be followed by a confirmatory treponemal-based assay, such as the fluorescent treponemal antibody absorption test, or FTA-ABS, enzyme immunoassay, or EIA, microhemagglutination assay, or MHA-TP, etc. However, Dr. Katz confirmed that advances in performing the latter tests, including decreased time and costs, have switched the order of this testing, the so-called reverse sequence screening algorithm, in which the treponemal-based assays should be performed first, followed by non-treponemal tests. Clinicians adopting this approach should be advised that situations may occasionally arise in which the treponemal tests are positive, whereas the non-treponemal assays are negative. If so, Dr. Katz advised seeking further guidance from one's local Department of Public Health or an infectious disease specialist. Epidemiologic trends indicate a twofold increase in incident primary and secondary syphilis in the United States since 2000, from 2.1 cases per 100,000 persons to 5.3 cases per 100,000 persons in 2013. We can be certain that our expertise in diagnosing and managing this disorder will likely be needed for many more years to come. I hope you enjoyed this edition of Dialogues in Dermatology. Next month, we'll have a special men's theme for November, including dialogues about male genital dermatology, aesthetic male dermatology, and other more macho subjects as well. Remember, we now have a presence on Facebook, and we'd like you to join us online for previews, info, and fun. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. Keep up all the great work you're doing on behalf of your patients. Your expertise and hard work is respected and makes your colleagues and your community proud. Remember to stay passionate about dermatology and have another great month.